And is Messman versus Crane, Mr. Lazarus?
William Lazarus on behalf of the plaintiffs, John Messman and Judy Messman. May it please the court. On January 17th, 1998, 10 days after Cone Cranes, or Crane Pro Services, they're the same, completed its redesign and reconstruction.
Over the facts again. Come on.
All right. Certainly, it's before the court. I realize the three. I want to focus on two main points and touch on a third as to why a new trial is necessary. First, Cone Cranes shifted its stance of 6.5 years a week before trial. Said this is not a product that comes under the Products Liability Act. It was a service. Because it wasn't a product, Cone Cranes stated it had no duty to design and build a reasonably safe crane for the workplace at Incrametals. We objected to that. We objected that several times during the trial. The trial court allowed Cone Cranes to make that argument.
The crane is a product, obviously. Is this the cab? Is that what the problem is?
Well, Cone Cranes, the cab was part of the on-site conditions that we say Cone Cranes had to take into account, and this court said in its prior decision that Cone Cranes had to take into account in designing and building the reconstructed crane.
In your view, what exactly was Cone Cranes' role? Does the record contain a contract or any description of what their undertaking was to the plant owner?
Cone Cranes proposed to totally renovate, modernize the cranes at Incrametals.
Was this contained in the contract, or was it contained? One of the problems I've had with this whole doggone case is that I can't find any place where there's an explicit statement of what Cone Cranes' undertaking was.
Their witnesses spoke of specifically what Cone Cranes did, and what it did was it changed every moving part in that crane, and it put in new brains of the crane, as Mr. Patricio for Cone Cranes had described it, that controlled the movement of the crane.
So all that it was left with the steel parts.
Right? Of the old crane, right,
the antiquated old crane.
That's correct. And in the process of reconstructing the crane, they also lengthened the life of the crane.
Now, in the record, who was responsible for the decision to keep the cab?
The testimony is split on that. Cone Cranes said, Incrametals fellow who was there and supervising the project said, Cone Cranes. Either way, the Cone Cranes had a duty to design the crane it was building to be reasonably safe for the workplace at Incrametals.
Does Messman contest Crane Pro's assertion that Messman requested that the cab remain in place after Crane Pro suggested that it be removed?
It was Incrametals that was dealing with Crane Pro. John Messman had nothing to do with requesting the cab to stay in place or not stay in place. Yes, that is contested. The testimony of Mr. Hurtius with Incrametals, the representative who oversaw the product, said we weren't requesting, it was Crane Pro's suggestion that we keep the cab and it could be used as an alternate place to control the crane in case the radio control wasn't working.
What was the cab outfitted with new controls?
Yes. It was.
I see.
And the new controls completely changed the movement of the crane. One of the features was this delayed deceleration, which didn't exist on the old crane, where the crane would hoist up to 3 seconds more or a foot more after the reverse button was hit or the stop button.
One follow-up point, if I may. At the time of the accident, as I understand it, the crane was being operated by the remote device. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And was the person who was handling that remote device, I assume, was standing on the ground, not in the cab?
That's correct.
I see.
That's correct.
So he was actually, his line of sight was below the piece of sheet metal that was being raised?
Right. That was one of the factors. Standing on the ground, you don't have quite the same perspective as when they used to control it from the cab.
You don't. Whose fault was that?
That was the plan. The fault, in our vantage point, is that that cab should have been removed from the outset. It would have been relatively very cheap to do
but look,
so.
But cone cranes cannot go into this operation and say, we're going to rebuild your plant, you know, we're going to alter the weather, we're going to alter all the, we're going to train your employees. They can't do that, right? It has to be limited. So it gets back to Judge Ripple's question. What is their undertaking? Do they just take the cab as given, as part of what the structure that they are working within? Or do they have to tear it down? Or do they have to tell Crane to tell the company to tear it down, or what?
They at least, I mean, we would say they had to tear it down, that would make
it
a safe crane, but they would...
go into someone else's plant and start tearing things down, right? That's ridiculous.
All right. In that case, they at least had the duty
it's
to...
Not the at least. They can't go in and start rebuilding the plant. They're just hired. They're hired to... Now, maybe they're hired. This goes back to Judge Ripple's question. Maybe they're hired. Maybe they're told... rebuild the crane and make any other structural changes that you have to make so that it works safely. That's one possibility. The other possibility is they're told, here's the building, got this cab, you know, we're going to leave it there, and you're going to have to build around it. That's another possibility. Now, maybe when they do that, maybe they have to tell the company, well, look, we can do that, but, you know, there's going to be a safety problem because that cab is too close to the ground.
And that's the point. They at least
have... Well, these briefs are really unhelpful. All this junk about the law of the case and so on. It's a simple negligence case. Did Cone Cranes have a duty to warn about the cab? Is that the case, that they
yes.
had a duty to warn and they didn't warn?
They at least had a duty to warn about the cab, yes.
So now, what rulings are... You didn't put the rulings in your brief. I'm not clear exactly what they are. But what are the rulings by the judge that you think prevented the jury from properly considering this simple theory of liability?
Prior to trial, we had a motion in limine that asked that... to not allow this argument that the Products Liability Act didn't apply. We saw it. And then
the Products Liability Act. What do you have to get into that?
The ruling basically was that, yes, Cone Cranes could make...
There's no practical difference between a design error and negligence. So forget that act.
So you
have a simple negligence argument. Now... are there rulings by the judge or actions by the jury? What is it that you think prevented? Well, of course, you got a verdict from the jury, right? Then the judge.
That's true.
Got rid of it. Okay. So what is it you think? Where do you think the judge erred in regard to your theory?
The judge erred in allowing the issue of whether Cone Cranes had a duty to build a reasonably safe cab, whether it had a duty to warn of an unsafe feature of the cab. The court erred in allowing Cone Cranes to argue that this was a matter to the jury that it had no such duty. This was a question of law for the court to decide under, you know.
I don't understand that. The duty is the duty they assume in their you have a bunch of potential contributors to this accident. The cab is a contributor. The person operating the device, the hoist, and then of course it's Cone Cranes. So what is it that they're certainly entitled to argue that, you know, they just took the cab for granted and, you know, was safe enough? Or
this court in its prior decision spoke of Cone Cranes having a duty to design, build the cab to be safe for the conditions of Inc. for Metals, or reasonably safe, and discussed how Cone Cranes had argued that the the crane met code, the codes on building cranes. And this court said, well, that could be relevant evidence, but in this instance, it was not relevant because it didn't deal with the site-specific conditions, which included the cab.
Doesn't a lot of this come down to jury instruction 31? Because there, the judge told the jury that a manufacturer is not liable for open and obvious dangers. And that's just wrong. And it was directly contrary to Indiana law, and it was directly contrary, it seems to me, to judge, to the prior panel opinion. But the problem was that that argument was waived in the district court.
Under the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, even though there was waiver, the plain error doctrine applies. This was an error that was plain. It was fundamental to the issues in this case, and it was unfair to John, and it undermined the integrity of these proceedings. It was if anything is plain error, bad is plain error.
That's an issue.
All right.
No question whether, you know.
We think the third issue is the learned hand instruction. We requested instruction.
Instruction was all wrong.
Yeah.
Why don't you read, you know, Carol Towing? Not what it says.
Understand that it's if the burden of the repairs is less than the probability of the accident happening times the injury.
What does the instruction say?
I think it's a fair equivalent. The instruction says, if you find that in renovating the crane, the defendant failed to take effective precautions less expensive than the damages which could reasonably be expected to result from the crane's foreseeable use or misuse, then you may find the defendant negligent. And then there's a separate...
That's not the hand test. There's no reference to probability. The hand test is very simple. You stated it, more or less, but it's not in the instruction.
The damages which could reasonably be expected to result, we think, is a fair
That's
equivalent.
That's not what the learned hand test... Why didn't you just quote the learned hand test in Carol Towing?
Well, we didn't, so...
Very mishandled.
You know,
Your Honors,
could we talk about the jury instruction on incurred risk? Because that contains an incredible amount of very specific detail. And then states that unless Cone Cranes proves that Messman was aware of these precise dangers, he can't be found to have incurred any risk. And one of these specific dangers was that the steel sheets would then slide off the hooks, fall into the gondola toward John, splaying out like a deck of cards. Is it really an abuse of discretion for the district court to reject a jury instruction that requires such precise knowledge? What if he knew that the steel sheets would slide off the hooks, crashing down like a pile of bricks instead of splaying out like a deck of cards? I mean, don't you agree that this instruction just requires too much specific knowledge?
We put in specifics just to make clear that there's a difference between a general hazard of the steel sheet falling back into the rail car and the specific hazard that was faced with the continued hoist. I see my time is very limited, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lazarus. Ms. Campbell?
May it please the Court, Alyssa Campbell on behalf of the Appley Crane Pro. I would like to use most of my time addressing and commenting on the questions that were asked this morning, but I do just want to start off my argument by putting this whole argument in context, which is we're here after a denial of a new trial, and so the primary issue, or the issue, is can we say that this trial judge abused its discretion in denying a new trial in a case where there was no claim made to the trial judge that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence or the manifest weight of the evidence, where there was no claim of counsel error. Now on appeal, there is no claim of evidentiary error. What we really are dealing with are just three jury instructions out of 61 that were given to the jury, and all of which, in our contention, are waived.
Was there a genuine issue of triable fact on the scope of your client's undertaking?
Yes, there was a question of fact as to whether they were the manufacturer of the entire crane system, part of the crane, or, and more importantly, to what extent they were the manufacturer of components that were defective and caused the accident.
That's not the question I asked, really. That's the maybe the conclusion we might reach or might not reach. But is what was the undertaking of the company? Is there a contract? Is there any? What does the testimony trial show as to what your client undertook to do for this person, for this company?
There was testimony at trial, and
but no contract. Am I right?
The contracts were admitted into evidence, and I can point the court. I don't have the contracts with me this morning, but I can point you to the pages of the record if the court wants to.
Take
a look at this. It came up largely in the testimony of Michael Petrito, who was a district manager for Crane Pro, and his testimony is in volume 4C of the record. And on pages 16 to 17 of volume 4C, he discussed, or actually it starts at page 15, he discusses exhibits C and D, which are the contracts. And this is my index of the trial testimony, and I believe this is a quote of his testimony. He explained what the scope of the work was. He said, "We removed their existing DC hoist trolley unit in total and installed the new cone cranes hoist trolley unit. We also provided new bridge drives, which was the second proposal, the addendum, the follow-up proposal. It means a totally new bridge drive, which is the gearbox motor set that drives the crane up and down the runway. We provided the control panels of the control cabinet, which were the, let's just say, the brains of all three motions, which contained the variable frequency drives, the mainline, and also the magnet controls for the hoist. We also supplied a radio remote control system consisting of a transmitter and a receiver, and we also supplied a new festoon system, which provides power to the hoist trolley unit."
Careful to use there that he supplied this component. Was there any antecedent responsibility by your client to advise the owner of this plant as to what he needed?
No. In fact, the testimony at trial also came out that on page 18 of Mr. Petrito's testimony, that at the customer's request, they provided a backup push-button pendant control hardwired into the cab. Also on pages 2 to 3...
That's with respect to the cab.
Yes, and on pages 2 to 3 of our brief, we give the record sites for the point that Crane Pro was not hired to do a safety analysis. They were not hired to redo the entire crane system. Of course, this was a gigantic warehouse with this steel crane system
that was part of the
warehouse.
So in the first case, the one where they got the jury verdict, and then it was set aside, and then we reversed on it. So I thought the issue was whether their control, their hand control that was used to move the crane back and forth and that led to the accident, whether that was safe given conditions including the cab. Now, what happened in the second trial? I mean, did that issue continue to be salient?
Did
it get all fogged up?
The configuration of the control was still an issue, but what happened in the second trial was that and one of the reasons we take issue with the plaintiff's whole first argument is that the district court essentially allowed the plaintiff to submit theories to the jury that went even beyond the theories that they were allowed to submit the first time around. Because in the first trial, there were, through summary judgment rulings, elimination of certain issues and certain theories and common law negligence claims. This time, the judge gave the plaintiff a lot more freedom, a lot more room as to what they could argue to the jury. And the plaintiff's expert had four theories as to why...
These were presented in the second trial?
Yes, in the second trial, as to why this crane was defective. One was that the hoist limit switch was set at an improper setting. Secondly, was that this deceleration that was programmed into the hoist was
too slow.
Third was that they couldn't reverse plug.
Right, right.
And fourth was that this controller violated the ASME code. But really what the expert was focusing on in terms of the
How could cone cranes be liable for the controller? I don't understand.
Because they didn't manufacture it?
Oh, I thought by the control you meant the human being.
No, I mean the remote control.
Remote control, yeah.
Correct.
Oh, and what was that fourth theory about the remote control?
But really, if you read Williamson's testimony, that's the plaintiff's expert, what he was focusing on was this concept that it should have been a joystick control versus a push-button control.
That was all in the first trial, wasn't it? Yeah. The joystick business.
Yes. Then there was a human factors expert who testified to that. This time there was an engineer, but his testimony was just as lacking in that there was still no evidence of causation that would have linked up, that had there been this joystick versus the push button, it would have prevented Mr. Van Til, the operator, from doing what he did. But I think... There's two main points.
Just repeat. You said there were four theories, and what were the first two?
That the limit switch allowed the spreader bar to hit the cab, the setting of the limit switch. Second was the deceleration timing. Third was that you couldn't reverse plug, and fourth was that this controller supposedly violated the code.
So I'm sorry, when the limit switch was in the wrong place, or?
Well, he was saying that the limit switch was improperly set so that you could lift the spreader bar high enough to hit the bottom of the cab.
The limit was too generous.
But.
So, well, what happened between the first and second trial? Because in the first trial they get a verdict, in the second trial you get a verdict, so. What had happened? What had changed? Besides,
you
want to
know what I think accounts for the difference in the verdicts? Well, I think if you look back at the trial testimony from the first trial, which I've skimmed through, but not committed to memory, but I think you'll see there were a lot of errors, some of which aren't even discussed in this court's opinion, that all contributed to this large plaintiff's verdict. Not the least of which was that the plaintiff violated an in limine ruling and put in evidence of Crane Pro performing subsequent remedial measures and changing the deceleration setting. Crane Pro moved for a mistrial based on the violation of that in limine order. Now, that doesn't all come through in the opinion, but there were errors like that that contributed to getting a plaintiff's verdict in this case, which explain why in our trial, where even though the plaintiff was given every opportunity to present every conceivable theory of what we might have done wrong, where there was a fair trial, the jury came back with the right result.
But could jury number 31 have been the big problem, where you have a judge telling a jury that a manufacturer is not liable for open and obvious dangers?
Well,
I mean, that's just flat out wrong.
If the judge had only instructed the jury in the manner that you're excising from this instruction and said merely a manufacturer is not liable for open and obvious dangers, period, perhaps there would be an issue about plain error to talk about. But we have to look at this jury instruction as worded, look at it in context, at all the words in the instruction, and also this instruction in the context of all the instructions given. And what this instruction actually says is a manufacturer has no duty to warn of and is not liable for open and obvious dangers. That those words, and is not liable for, relate to the issue of that they have no duty to warn of. Again, this... The reason that this makes sense is that there were various theories presented to the jury. Duty to warn was only one of them. And this instruction, when you read it, the whole instruction in context, is only dealing with this concept of duty to warn. So the not liable for is merely the flip side of the coin of telling the jury.
I'm puzzled about this. Who is supposed to be warned here? Usually when we think of an open, obvious danger issue, we think of, you know, a machine or something that the operator could fall into. But that's not the relevant duty here. It's not warning Messman, right? It's not that it's obvious to Messman. So who's it supposed to be obvious to? I don't understand why an instruction on open and obvious is in the case. Who are you warning?
Well, for one, we're warning... Well, the issue is whether we need to warn either Inframetals or the operator of the crane about this... about the fact that the spreader bar could hit the cab.
Well, actually...
Well, what's strange about it is to say the duty to warn is usually discussed in reference to a person who is endangered, right? Not another person in the chain of production, so to speak, or service person.
Well, the plaintiff had a somewhat confusing approach to arguing the case and what duty to warn they were talking about, but I think
what happened here is that the previous opinion in this case specifically noted that the open and obvious defense had been replaced with an incurred risk defense. And it was also noted in that opinion that whether a risk is open and obvious remained relevant to liability, and hence on whether the risk was great enough to warrant protective measures. But the opinion also made clear that an open and obvious danger is not a complete defense to liability. That's what brings us to this quagmire.
But that was only in the context of a design defect case. And if you look at page 850 of the opinion, it states, Cone Cranes argues that it had no legal obligation to protect against such a danger. The duty to warn issue wasn't relevant in the first opinion because that there had been summary judgment in Cone Crane's favor on the duty to warn. And so when the opinion is discussing that open and obvious is not a defense, it's talking about only in terms of design defect. Here, again, this instruction read fairly is only dealing with the issue of duty to warn, which the first Messman opinion doesn't address. And in fact, the plaintiffs have essentially conceded, I believe their briefs do concede, that open and obvious danger remains a viable defense to a duty to warn claim under Indiana law.
So are you saying that the danger was obvious? Well, not necessarily to the operator, but to the employer. Is that the idea? To Inframetals?
Well, our position was that
not obvious to Messman. So
our position was that the danger of the spreader bar hitting the bottom of the cab was an open and obvious danger to everyone. The testimony at trial was that it had happened many times in the past. In fact, it happened that morning. there was testimony that just that morning Van Til had hit the bottom of the cab, and Alex Arce told him, be careful, don't do that. And there was a cab in evidence.
Your argument is that they had no duty to warn. On the other hand, suppose that at a cost of 50 cents, they could have eliminated the problem. Now, would it be open to Messman to argue that they were negligent, Cohn-Cranes was negligent in failing to spend another 50 cents, which would have completely eliminated the problem?
Well, I think that question begs some other questions and different answers, such as what was the scope?
That's the question discussed in the opinion. That's why open and obvious is no longer a defense, because you can have an open, obvious thing. You know, however, there are some dopes, you know, and people make mistakes and they're inadvertent. And if you can prevent an open, obvious danger very, very cheaply, you may be negligent for failing to do it, right?
But now, that's part of the learned hand philosophy, but what that doesn't accommodate, which was an issue.
What doesn't accommodate, that's what we held in our previous case, and that's what the Indiana legislature appears to have done with the changing open and obvious to incurred risk. So my question is, was the jury permitted to consider the possibility that even though this was an obvious danger, happened many times before, still the jury could find that it would have been so easy to prevent it that Cohn-Cranes was negligent for failing to prevent it?
The jury could consider that. There was testimony and argument throughout the whole trial about how cheap it would have been to remove the cab, and how there was conflicting testimony about whether you could or couldn't set these different limit switches to different heights in different parts of the plant. The jury instructions that were provided to the jury.
So you're saying that the only significance of this questioned instruction is that they couldn't go to the jury on a pure duty to warn issue, that Cohn-Crane should have written a letter to InfraMetal saying, and by the way, you know, be careful about bumping the cab. Is that what your argument comes down to?
Well, I think I was actually arguing or discussing a different issue, which was you were asking whether this jury could consider the costs. And I think that goes back to instruction number 36 that the court gave the jury, which was the definition of negligence. And I think within that, yes, the jury could consider all of that, and there was testimony in there. But when I was talking about begging the question, I think it goes back to your question in the very beginning of the arguments today to Mr. Lazarus about what was the scope of the work, and that was something else the jury had to consider. And the testimony shows, and we have the record cites in our brief, that it was InfraMetal's decision to keep the cab, that Crane Pro advised them that there were some structural problems with the cab, and that InfraMetals told Crane Pro they didn't want them working on the cab. They took it upon themselves to fix it and specifically requested that this system be hardwired, this new system be hardwired into the cab. And one of the InfraMetal supervisors admitted it would have been foolish to do that had they not wanted to keep the cab. So that's why I say it begs the question. All of this the jury was able to consider.
There certainly arrives a point at which, or one arrives at a point at which you're asked to do something, and the person who's hired you to do it has surrounded your undertaking with so many restrictions that what you're going to do is going to be dangerous. You can't just say, well, fine, you want me to design a crane that that if the operator is off by, you know, a quarter of an inch, will bring down the roof. Fine, we'll do that.
Well, there could be such a case, but again, this was a case that went to the jury on evidence for both parties. And we had an expert, Mr. Laughlin, who testified that the parts that we put in and the way that the crane was operating as with the deceleration, with the limit switches as they were not defective. In fact, that the hoist unit was state of the art, and that there was no defect. So Here, the jury heard conflicting evidence on it, and with no other error in the trial, they found for the defendant.
Okay. Should be affirmed. Thank you, Ms. Campbell. Mr. Lazarus, how much time does he have? 1 minute? Have anything further?
At one point, the crane operator, Ray Van Til, said it was incredibly stupid for John Messman to stay in the rail car. This is the type of thing he later said, well, there might be reasons because getting in and out in these icing conditions, that's a problem. But this is the type of thing that sticks in the jury's mind, and they hear the instruction, open, obvious, the absolute instruction, opening, obvious, it sticks. And
so
that plain error has an impact.
Why did you object to the instruction?
We should have. We didn't. That was our error, but under the Rule of Civil Procedure 51, we still have plain error review.
We're very reluctant to invoke plain error in an instruction, especially when you had two trials already.
I understand
one
that.
A third trial because you don't object to instructions?
I understand
you're
that. I also
you're not going to object. You're going to lose. You're going to come up. You're going to say it was plain error again.
It was directly contrary to this court's decision. So, and then beyond that,
it's not clear that it's directly contrary because, you know, as we're discussing with Ms. Campbell, the issue isn't the duty to warn. The issue is whether there was a very cheap way of avoiding the accident given the presence of the cab. That's the issue, and apparently that was fully ventilated, wasn't it?
I believe so in our position. It was fully ventilated, but it was an issue of law that the Products Liability Act applied.
No,
Gallo case said a combination of reconstruction plus lengthening the life. Concrane said it did it. That brings the Products Liability Act to bear. It's a matter of law.
It doesn't matter whether it brings the Liability Act to bear. You still have to prove a defect.
Well, the defect was they failed to take simple and cheap measures to make it safe.
Yes, but the question whether there were simple and cheap measures, that was the central issue in the trial. That was fully litigated. It doesn't matter whether it's litigated under negligence or litigated under the Illinois Products Liability Act. The same issue, same considerations bear on both.
And the opening obvious point, it may have been opening obvious that the crane could hoist its load into the spreader bar, bump it, that had happened. But in 25 years, it never happened that there was a tilting, hoist continued, and the load lost, according to the crane operator who'd been there that long.
Mr. Lazarus, are all of the instructions in the record, are all of the instructions from beginning to end in the record?
They're part of the trial court's instructions. They're there digitally, all of the instructions from beginning to end. I don't think they're repeated in our appendix. They should be part of the record.
No, but I could not find them in the appellate record. That's why I'm asking.
Well, they would exist electronically in the district court.
Doesn't help me too much. Secondly, I noticed that the magistrate judge sitting as a district judge here apparently held an off-the-record instruction conference. Is that correct?
There was a lengthy off-the-record conference, correct, before, and then there was a brief on-the-record conference.
Well, we don't have it. I've read that transcript. That doesn't tell us anything about what went on substantively at that conference, does it? I can't.
No, it does not.
Don't we have a rule in this circuit, don't we, that we instruction conferences get recorded?
That could be. I wasn't a participant, but
that
could be.
Okay, well, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.